Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with writer, showrunner, and Kleenex salesman, Jason Kadams. Like many kids growing up on the East Coast in the early 80s, Jason Kadams wanted to be Bruce Springsteen. But with some encouragement from an English teacher, Jason discovered that he was a born storyteller, if not quite born to run. So instead, he became Jason Kadams, writer and producer of some of the most successful dramatic shows on television. From Friday Night Lights to Parenthood and now Rise, Jason's been creating characters and stories that resonate in powerful and often tearful ways. The key to Jason's writing is that he creates characters who are always putting their best foot forward, fighting against others' expectations, and reflecting back to us our own humanity. Some writers say the key is to create flawed characters, but Jason sees it differently. They're not flawed characters, he says. They're people, and most people are striving to be the best versions of themselves, even if they fail a good portion of the time. Jason had to overcome high expectations when he took on Friday Night Lights and was met with a phalanx of executives and agents who questioned his ability to build upon the success of Peter Berg's feature film and subsequent pilot. The pressure he was under gave him insight into the character of Coach Taylor, played by Kyle Chandler, and helped him find a way in, a process he has tried to replicate ever since. When I spoke with Jason, it became clear how real these characters are to him, which begins to explain the emotional attachment that viewers, myself included, have with his shows. Jason joins Off Camera to discuss how he is revolutionizing the way stories are told in ensemble drama series, why Parenthood was his most personal project to date, and why he wanted to tell the story of a small-town drama teacher who has a unique gift in his newest show, Rise. I also found out that I was not the only one in the room that day who tears up when watching his shows. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my God. I'm so happy to do it. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, I have been a fan of your work for a long time, before I knew it was your work.
Uh-huh.
And as a very new father and a new husband, I would find myself on the couch at night, wife's asleep, kids are asleep, and watching Friday Night Lights first and then on into Parenthood. And I would just find myself sitting on the couch, gutted and bawling. and finally,
at least you were alone. It was, you know,
I'd be alone.
There to witness it.
That's good. Would be sitting there looking at me, what is wrong with you?
I always get emotional watching episodes, and I watch them in the editing room, and I don't want the editors to know that I'm getting emotional because it's, you know, kind of embarrassing to get emotional by stuff that you wrote, you know?
Yeah.
And so these weird sounds come from me sometimes when I'm in the editing room, and it's the sound of me trying not to show that I'm emotional, and I have these those kind of weird sounds, and it's embarrassing. So you had the,
yes,
you know,
it's funny you say that, yeah. Because literally after a couple of years, I started reading credits like, who is this guy that's Jason Kadams that's making me cry? You know, and you know, what I started thinking about was why is this happening, and what is it about the shows and the characters I'm connecting with? And one of the first characters I look at in that emotional realm is Coach Taylor, you know, played by Kyle Chandler on Friday Night Lights. And I think that character had such a strong moral code and was always trying his hardest. And I think it was the father and the husband I wanted to be.
Mm.
Like, do you find that it's a more emotional or more connective experience when those characters are pushing themselves? Or,
I mean, I think there's sort of like two things that I sort of think about as I'm writing, as I'm sort of approaching a story or a character that connect to that. I mean, one thing is to find my way in, to find what makes this personal to me. You know, when I came onto Friday Night Lights, I'm not from Texas, I wasn't really like a football guy, you know, growing up, and I had to like find a way to sort of like my way in. So how do I connect to Coach? And interesting, the way it kind of, and it always sort of happens in its own way on any different project and with any different character. And with Coach Taylor, you know, what happened was when I came onto the show, I came on after, you know, there was this beautiful book, Friday Night Lights book, written by Buzz Bissinger, who was an incredible piece of nonfiction. Then there was this incredible movie that Pete Berg directed. And then I came on after the pilot of Friday Night Lights was done. So when I came on to the show, there's this thing that they do when, you know, at the networks, when all the, this upfront presentation, when all the their shows for the fall are picked up.
Right.
And so I went to the upfront presentation in New York. Usually I go there because it's a pilot that I made and I did. But in this case, I had not. I wasn't the person who made the pilot. And I, you know, hadn't done anything on the show yet. I felt like an imposter. And to add to the pressure that I felt, and you know, I started to people. Literally, there was a thing where an executive pulled me aside and said, "Jason, you know, like, are you going to be able to do this? Are you going to be able? Are you going to handle this? Are you going to be, you know, whatever?" And then I was ran into. There was an agent who I ran into at another party who said, "Wow, the pilot, so brilliant, you know. I just don't know where the show goes. I just don't know that there is a show."
And you know, I talk about a vote of confidence.
Right, so what happened was what I felt like there was all this expectation on me and all this questioning and doubt about whether I would be able to sort of do this. And I was like, oh, this is exactly what Coach Taylor was going through in the at the beginning of the show. It's like there was all this expectation on him to win state, but then his, you know, quarterback gets paralyzed and but there's still that expectation, and he was a man who was sort of dealing with you know, how do I kind of like, how do I stay in my zone and do what I do and sort of fend off how the world is looking at me? And so it was sort of my way into like how I was able to sort of jump in and write that and work on that. So that was kind of like the my sort of thing that makes it personal. So you can get sort of inside these people, inside these characters, even though sometimes their lives are very different than your life and their concerns are sort of different than yours. But if you find your way in, then you can make it personal, and that's when I think things start to resonate when people watch those stories.
Yeah, I believe that you can't transfer that emotion if you're not feeling it or if you're not acquiring it honestly or authentically, I think. Because when I think of your shows, like obviously Coach Taylor on Friday Night Lights and Adam Braverman on Parenthood and now Lou on Rise, they're all these sort of strong father figures. And I wondered, looking at those shows, if that's the character on each show that you really have to identify with to find your center.
Yeah, I do and I don't. You know, I mean, I think that certainly those, all of those characters are characters that I have an easy way in to connect to them because they're fathers and part of a family. But one of the things that I found they all share in just in terms of just the sort of DNA of the shows, is they're all these very large ensemble storylines. And it's something that I discovered in Friday Night Lights that, you know, normally in the old way of like thinking of writing a one-hour television episode of, you know, of a drama, people would say, well, you know, you sort of have an A story and a B story and a C story and a runner. And, you know, the A story was really the story you were following, and then there were a B story that was somewhat less, and the C story was like less, and the runner was just a little touch of a thing. And we, like, that never really occurred to me at all in Friday Night Lights, you know. And what happened was by leaning into these this ensemble and basically playing not just Coach's life or, you know, Tammy Taylor's life, but all of them. And not even just the sort of the main series regular characters, but then you start to get into these sort of supporting characters, but you start to tell stories about them. And to me, like, that was magic to me, you know, discovering that. It was a way of writing that I sort of never imagined. I mean, I had done sort of ensemble shows before, but never in that with that kind of sort of, I don't know, sort of brave approach where you're just going to like not, you're just going to tell all of these stories, you know?
Yeah, and, so do you see them all as A stories or do you see them as, you just don't even qualify them?
I see them as all pretty equal. Like, you know, when we break them, you know, on the board, which is what, you know, sort of what we do, they all generally have about the same amount of scenes in them. I do feel like when you do a show that's like a true ensemble like that, you know, what I always look for is like kind of what is the story that pulls you in right away? What's the one that's sort of like arresting and thinking, oh, this is going to make you, pulls you into the story? And I find that when you have that, then it takes weirdly takes the pressure off of the other stories, and you can tell more sort of nuanced storylines where you don't have to bite off that much story. And that a lot of times what you're sort of following is some nuanced storyline that is that sort of feels like real life. It feels like, oh, this is something that I might have gone through this week or something like that. And the other thing that happens, you know, when you have that many stories going on in an episode, it also makes doing the show more forgiving, because, you know, sometimes, you know, you do episodes and something surprises you that's like, wow, this is way more moving than I even realized it was going to be. You know,
do you mean in the sense of you actually shoot a scene that day and the actors bring something to it imagine?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what I always say is, like, you know, the beauty of doing television is it's this collaborative form. And a lot of times, you know, as a writer or a showrunner, you know, I think, you know, one of the things I've kind of learned over time is to embrace that, embrace the collaborative nature of it. So that the idea is like, what I'm hoping to see when I watch the episode in the editing room, my hope is that what I see exceeds what I could have imagined myself the episode to be. You don't want it to feel like, if I could say every line, and if I could, you know, if I could direct every shot, the episode would be the best possible
version.
Just
the way it's in my head.
In the way, right. Yeah. What you want it to be is like a director brings something that you're like, oh, wow, I didn't see it that way. And this is so much more, this is so much more meaningful than what I had imagined. And of course, with actors. And by the way, the sort of hidden kind of, the unsung heroes of television, who are the editors and the camera operators. You know, the camera operators in Friday Night Lights, you know, when we had this very free-flowing style, those camera operators would, like, find things. It's not like the director said, okay, pan up from here and find... No. So those camera operators, and you never hear. You hear about DPs, you hear about directors. People don't really celebrate camera operators, but I'm telling you, they are responsible for so much in Friday Night Lights and Parenthood and Rise.
There are a window into it, and there are eyes on deciding, especially in an ensemble, what to look at what time.
Right, and if they're able to be storytellers. You know, I always find when you see something happen in the camera rather than cutting, it's so much more powerful. You know what I mean? So when you see the camera move from one person to the other, or see their whatever, their finger, you know, they're wringing their fingers and moving to their face, or whatever it is, a lot of times those are things that are discovered in the moment. The other thing about shooting that I learned on Friday Lights and have employed in every show I've done since then is this sort of shooting three cameras and as much as possible cross-covering, so that we shoot both sides, like we're doing now, both sides at once.
Right, right.
But it's not traditionally the way 1 hours are done or have been done.
Well, and it's funny, a lot of DPs would make that into a problem by saying the eye lines aren't right. You can't shoot both sides at once, or...
Right. It's definitely like you always have to push DPs and camera crews and operators, you know, you have to at first, you know... sometimes push them to work that way. And then once they do, you know, I mean, so many people have said, I never want to go back to working the other way. But I found for the shows that I do, having that allows the, you know, you're in a situation where the actors actually get to act with each other and respond to each other.
In
and
a theatrical way, too, or in a documentary way, too. I mean, what I was drawn to about Friday Night Lights is I felt oftentimes... just like you said, if it's done in the editing room, it's a manipulation, plain and simple.
Right.
It's we're looking at this, now we're going to look over here, we're going to get a reaction.
Right.
But the cut itself tells the viewer that was planned out.
Right, right.
But if the camera can find it, then it's that documentary feel of we are...
Right, but it's also about the process of acting. So if you're acting and you do a scene and you wind up doing that scene 5 or 10 times or more,
yeah.
But you know, between the time when you sort of rehearse it, then you go and you know we're doing the master, and then you come in for the coverage, you're doing that scene a lot of times, right? But so if you're shooting, like, let's say we're shooting a scene and we're shooting just all of your coverage first, and we do your part of the scene,
which people should know, that's how we shoot this show,
right?
I shoot mine and then a week later you come in.
Right. But if we shoot all of your coverage right. first, which is the normal way of kind of the traditional way of doing it, and then, you know, by the time we come around and shoot me, you know, the scene might have evolved and changed, right? It's like, you know, it's like actors, when they do a scene, it keeps evolving and changing and, you know, getting more nuanced and more interesting. So it's like, well, by the time we wind up shooting me, it's like, we're almost doing like a different version of the scene. That's why when you can shoot both things at once, it gives the actors this freedom to discover things in the moment with each other. And you know that when you get a reaction, you know, you're cutting to a true reaction in the moment. And sometimes, especially on shows like Friday Night Lights, there are moments that were sort of discovered in the process of shooting the scene that was a surprise to both, to the actors in the scene at the moment. So you're getting those real reactions.
Yeah.
And so, it, you know, I remember somebody saying about Friday Night Lights, or maybe this is what I thought when I was first doing it, was like, you know, the idea of like, it's not really a documentary. We never obviously claimed it was, but it does have this feeling that you sort of drop down into this town and you're just kind of getting to watch these people.
Yes,
you know, it
feels very much
sort of
so.
Real. And I tried to do that again to some degree with Parenthood and to a greater degree again with Rise, which is very much about the town that it's set in as it is about, you know, anything else about the show. And that, to me, it just says all these details help give you the feeling of these are people that I know. You know, I may not have ever set foot in Texas, but I know Tyra Collette, I know Matt Saracen, like I know these people, and you connect to them. And I think it's a combination of factors that contribute to it, but a lot of it is sort of how you approach shooting it.
Well, listen, that brings up so many questions, because I think of the guy that's at the upfronts with imposter syndrome going, gosh, I'm taking this beautiful piece of work and I have to adapt it. And I'm curious how you had the courage to sort of break all these rules and try these things and not let A stories dominate or not, mm-hmm. you know, not lean into your highest paid actors.
Sure.
At the same time while you were proving yourself.
I will say, like, in this, when I did the second episode of Friday Night Lights, I did feel a lot of pressure, because I did feel like, okay, we have to prove that we're going to be able to do on a week-to-week basis what was done kind of in the pilot. And then I also felt like what we had to do was make make it into a show that wanted to live for, you know, many, many episodes and over seasons, and not just have it be like, you know, the story of one game. And in order to do that, we needed to know these characters in a way that you don't get to know them in a 45-minute pilot, you know?
Right. You had to sort of trust that the audience is going to hang around long enough for you to build the foundation or something, right?
I think so. But you also had to just jump in and say, who are these people? Like, who is, you know, Tammy Taylor, aside from this really, you know, cool wife of a football coach? Who is she? What makes her tick? Who, you know, Matt Saracen, the backup quarterback, we don't see that much, you know, in the pilot, other than establish his friendship with Landry and a sort of crush on the coach's daughter. But like, what's his life? What's his world? You know?
Right.
And that was fantastic. I have to say, the other thing about Friday Night Lights, which was unique, is, you know, we shot the show in Texas, which was, you know, great. We also never, we didn't build a single set, so every location that we go to is a real place. And that obviously helped in sort of like the feeling, the authenticity and the feeling of it. But, you know, as a writer, as a showrunner, you know, if you build those sets, you know, those sets are expensive. And you have to then write scenes to play in those sets.
Right, right? Because you already have the set built.
You have those sets. So therefore, you know, you're going to, you know, if we were going to, if we were going to do Friday Night Lights in a traditional way, we would have built the coach's house. We would have, you know, built the field house. And I'm telling you, that show would have had a lot more scenes in the coach's house and the field house than it did. Because when you don't build stuff, you know, well, all right, let's go to see where, let's go to Saracen's house. Let's go to Tyra Collette's house. Let's see what that world is like. So you're less restricted. And literally the fact of that put us in a position of being so bold in terms of our storytelling.
Right.
I mean, I remember at one point in the first season, we went to Tyra's house for the first time and we met her mom and her sister. And I watched that episode. I mean, like, I'm the guy, right? Like, I was like the showrunner.
You decided to go
and
there.
I watched that episode. And after I saw Tyra with her mom and her sister and the house that they lived in, I was like, oh, now I know who Tyra Collette is. You know what I mean? It was like such a epiphany to see her in her world. So it was like, you know, if you remember that show, like in the pilot, Tyra was this sort of like hot girl, the sexy girl who was flirting with Smash and flirting with different people. And it really didn't go much further than that, you know? And when you think of where that character got to when she was applying to college and she, you know, her, when and you know, getting into college and all the things that she sort of dealt with over the years on seasons on the show, her journey was unbelievable. And to be able to do a show where we were free to explore all of those things was really something that was an incredible tool for us as writers to be able to do that. And a learning experience for me. Like I took that to Parenthood and I took that to Rise.
Well, it almost seems, hearing you talk about them, it almost seems like you create situations in your own head where these become real people to you. Is that
Absolutely, yeah.
Like how does that sort of manifest in the process of creating a character and then trying to be an observer and then go back in? Is there some weirdness that goes on in your mind with how you think of these people and how you speak of them? And
yeah, first of all, it's an act of, you know, doing what we do. It's an act of falling in love. You fall in love with all of your characters. I mean, that's what happens whether you mean it to or not. You know, you love them and you care about them. And when they make mistakes, you wish they hadn't made the mistakes that you, in fact, wrote them, you know, that you
yeah,
wrote for them to
that's
do.
That's a very meta thought but, to well, wish they didn't.
But it's true. It's like you kind of, I think, feel like you sort of have to honor what you think would really happen, you know, and have them do, you know, and of course, you know, people say have flawed characters, but they're not flawed characters. They're people. That's what people are, right? They're just, I feel like most people are striving to be the best version of themselves. And so that's how I approach characters. Very few people wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to do evil today. I'm going to do bad things, you know, and I don't really want to write about those people that there are. So it's sort of like you're looking at people who are trying to be the best version of themselves, but they're in situations where it's hard to do that. I mean, like Tim Riggins, he has this beautiful heart and he's this incredibly charismatic and endearing character, but he has a tough situation. He's like a kid who doesn't have parents. He's got an older brother who's like screwed up and he's got like, stuff like inside of him. He's got anger inside of him and he's got all of these kinds of
So how do you put yourself
things
there? Because the thing I sort of said at the beginning, which is you're these main characters, but it sounds like you're all the characters and you have to be able to sort of understand them in an intimate way.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of my job. One thing is I do feel like you're in a relationship and a conversation with your actors. And sometimes the conversation never, actually happens in conversations. Sometimes it happens with, you know, you write something and then you, and then they perform it, and then you see what happens in the editing room, and then you discover things about them through that, and you sort of write toward that. To me, it's never as simple as, I know exactly who this character is, and I need to inform the actress or the actor who that is. It's more like this conversation that goes on and evolves. And the beautiful thing, and the reason to do television as opposed to doing like a play or movies, is that it's you get to tell a long story. You get to tell a story that happens over years of somebody's life. You know, in these shows, you get to watch, you know, in Parenthood, you get to watch, you know, when I think about this kid, Max, who in the pilot, you know, they're discovering has Asperger's syndrome. You start there and you get to do a show where you take him to his high school graduation and take him and his family with him on that journey through so much shit, you know? And so what you do is you...
Can I interrupt there for a minute?
Sure.
I read about that, and that story moved me incredibly. I read that your son has Asperger's, mm-hmm. and you went through that journey. And obviously, you're going to know about that and understand the personal side of that situation. But what I was curious about is what it was like for you to have to learn how to communicate with your son on a different level or understand a different way of communicating emotions, and then to have to process that and try to write it.
The thing that was slightly different about Parenthood than any other show that I've done was there was more autobiographical elements infused into that show than other shows. And the reason why that came up, telling the story about Max in Parenthood, was, you know, when I was taking on the show, when I was basically doing an adaptation of, you know, Ron Howard's movie, along with Brian Grazer. By the way, I came to them and said, I want to do a television show of Parenthood. I sort of was asking their blessing and partnership in doing it. And, you know, what Ron said was great, but don't, you know, like, I don't want to see the movie Parenthood again. You know what I mean? Like, I did that movie. That was actually a very personal movie to me, and I'm very proud of that movie. So, I'll trust you to do this, but you have to find a way to make it your story. And so I started thinking, like, okay, what's different for, what can I bring to this? And, you know, it was like my experience as a father of a son with Asperger's was staring me in the face. And then it was like a question of whether I was going to make the choice to bring that into it. And it was a very tough choice to make.
I imagine,
you know,
it was.
At the time when we were, the story in the pilot story was, you know, he's asked to leave his school, and the parents have to find another school for him.
Right.
Well, when I was writing the pilot episode, that happened to my son. You know, where the school that he was in was not working; it was not a good fit, and we had to find another place for him to go to school quickly. You know, and for anybody who has a child who has some sort of disability, you know that finding a place for them to go to school is not easy. And, you know, so that would literally that happened as I was writing the pilot. So there were times when I sort of pulled the Max story out of the pilot.
Really?
And I was like, this is not, you know, it's too, also at the time, you know, television and broadcast television was different than it is now. So the idea of tackling an issue like autism, you know, it hadn't been done. You know, I had this concern that it was like if people were going to see it and they would be like, that's too weird or I don't relate or whatever. And the irony was that storyline was the storyline that became, for me, my North Star. Because that storyline was like the one when you watch the pilot episode that, to me, like broke through and kind of resonated in this unexpected way. And I think the show, you know, as we continue to do the show, the rest of the show and the storylines got as intimate and personal and real.
In a way that set the bar for
It became like the kind of guiding principle of how we were going to tell these stories. And so what happened was, you know, the writer's room in Parenthood was, you know, about like, listen, everybody has to just bring in, like what I did in the pilot with this story, everybody has to bring in their shit. You know, everybody has to, not to say, it wasn't like I said, okay, we're going to have a therapy session, but it was like, that's the stuff of the show. It's like, we had to like sort of examine ourselves and our families and our friends and, you know, our, you know, and sort of like have that be like the sort of the fodder for which we sort of like broke stories. So that was particular to that show and how we kind of we approached it.
What did you learn about yourself through going through that process of having to look at something that was probably very painful and difficult in your own life and fuse that with your creative work?
You know, as I said, first of all, I learned that sometimes the thing that you think is going to be too narrow or too specific, actually, you know, for an audience,
exclude too many people.
The opposite happens, that people get pulled in. Like, that's one thing I learned, because it felt, it was real and it was true. The other thing that I got from that experience was, it was incredibly meaningful to the autism community, to the just the special needs community in general, because it was like they had, you know, somebody, there was somebody on television who was them, you know, they could see themselves and therefore their families on TV. It became a tool for people. Like, people could say, you know, like if you had your kid and your kid was sort of whatever acting out in a public place and people were looking at you like, why can't you keep, you know, control your kid, you know, then you could say, oh, well, you know the show Parenthood, you know that kid Max on Parenthood. Well, my son's a little like Max. I mean, I've heard these stories. I mean, these are the stories
I'm
that
sure.
I've heard. But that part of it was just, you know, like wound up being this incredibly rewarding thing for me to do. And it is, you know, satisfying to be able to, you know, tell a story that's you know, something that you're going through. There's a catharsis to that.
Yeah.
Although it's important for me to say, and I want to make sure I say, that Max Braverman is not my son. I made a very conscious choice to make a fictional character they both have Asperger's, but they're very, you know, they're different people. I don't think it would be fair to me or to my family, it's definitely to my son, to like tell a story that is literally his story.
Sure.
Although I will say sometimes I would come in, you know, after a weekend to the writer's room and, you know, you come into work and everybody says, how was your weekend? And everybody tells their story. And I would tell the story of what happened that weekend with my son or, what, you know, just in as not as pitching a story. And then I would have to go out to take a call and I'd come back. And the writers would be, okay, we have a story to pitch you. And literally, they just told that story. I was like, why? Why is that happening?
Well, but, I mean, did it ever give you reflection back on or help you in terms of how to deal with your own situation? Because your characters, like Adam Braverman and Coach Taylor and Lou Mazzucchelli, they're often pretty good instinctually in their gut of how to deal with a situation with their children.
Right.
And I was just curious if it, like, chicken and the egg, what comes first? Like, do you write about it and that helps you in your own life, or is it the other way around?
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of people will say, oh, yeah, I try to, like, model my parenting on Coach Taylor or Adam Braverman or something like that.
Do you
too? Me, the process is so mixed up and that, you know, like, the fiction and reality is sort of is a little kind of mixed up for me. So it's not like I sort of see it that way. But I do think it is. I would say it was very meaningful to tell that story. It was very, it was moving. Because what would happen is at the beginning of doing the show, I so regretted having to tell the story because it's like nobody knew. Like it was like I was the only person who knew anything about Asperger's. So I became, for like the writers and the actors and the directors, I became like the Asperger's consultant. Like I was the person.
Right.
And what happened was over time, it evolved. And Max Burkholder, who played Max, who's brilliant, created a character that was so real. And he did his own. I mean, he was a young kid when he got that part, and he read books and he did research. And he like took it on in this way, like with this sort of wisdom way beyond his years, and created this character. And I remember one time I was directing him in a scene, and I asked him to say a line slightly differently than how it was written, and he said to me, "Oh," he said to me, "Max wouldn't say that," you know. And I was like, "This is so wonderful that he is taking ownership of this character in a way that it's relieved me from the onus of having to be like the authority on it."
Right.
And so the experience was very moving in that way. And it was slightly different than, as I said, any other thing I had ever written, because it was in a way just coming from a place that was a more, you always find your personal way in, you always make it your own. But this one was less sort of disguised than other stories,
right,
in that way.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Little break in the action while I talk about this week's sponsor, Ring. And I just want to say that this is a company that we have followed since the beginning of Off Camera. And we've obviously seen this company grow from its first appearance on Shark Tank to what it is now, which is the standard for video doorbell security, and so much more. And the truth is, Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Today, over a million people use the amazing Ring video doorbell to protect their homes. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. So now, they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects right to your phone with HD video and two-way audio that lets you know the moment anyone steps onto your property. See and speak to visitors, and even set off an alarm right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Whether you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on your home from anywhere. Ring Floodlight offers the ultimate in-home security with high-visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security into your hands. And I just want to say, beyond the security aspect, we also love the convenience factor at home. It's nice to know who's at your door, whether you're home or not, and whether or not you've received a package. And it's just the simplest app to use. So we really believe in this product at Off Camera. And if you love this show and support the show, take a minute and check Ring out. And just for listening to this, you can save up to $150 off a Ring security kit when you go to ring.com/offcamera. That's ring.com/offcamera. One more time, that's ring.com/offcamera. But the point is, if you go to their site and you put our code in, you will not only be supporting our show, you'll also be finding out about the easiest, most intuitive, and best video doorbell and security system out there. So check that out. With Ring, you're always home. And now let's get back to the show.
Well, I want to talk about Rise because I think in a different way, there's a similar thing going on. First off, this is your new show and it's a big ensemble cast, and it's the inspirational material or the source material was a book called Drama High.
Yes.
About a real life drama teacher who's still teaching, right? Lou
yes.
Volpe?
Well, he's retired now.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. What great source material, and right in line with your people, because I feel like you are very good at writing characters that have that ability to see something in somebody and make them feel like they're being seen.
Yeah.
Coach Taylor could do it with his football team, and I think that this guy Lou Volpe in real life did that. And I was curious. Yes. I know you come from a theater background.
Right.
I wondered if when you read this source material, if you said, oh, this could be me, I could be this guy, and I know who this guy is, and I know what he means to students.
Right.
Like, so when you read this book, what was it about it that spoke to you so much and said, this is a show?
You know, I think from the very first, even before I read the book, honestly, hearing the story of Lou, you know, this person who basically took this overlooked drama program in a public high school in a town that was suffering.
What town was it?
Well, the original town is Levittown, Pennsylvania. You know, we've fictionalized it for
sure.
The show, but the DNA of it and the sort of inspiration for it, you know, was such a simple story and such a beautiful story of him saying, no, I'm not just gonna like teach in this school, in this town where, you know, whatever the issues are with teenage pregnancy and drugs and unemployment and kids having to work two jobs and not being able to come to their class and all of the things that this town is dealing with, which we try to reflect in the show. This guy was saying, no, I'm not just gonna just be like, okay, take out your English books today. And he was somebody who was, he was driven to do more. And he took on this theater program without having ever directed himself. This was true of the real story, and it's true of the fictional story. He never directed anything. He wasn't an actor. He went to Broadway shows when he was a kid and loved it. That's it. He didn't know anything else. And he was an English teacher. And he would go by and he would watch rehearsals. And he would watch the way that the director was directing him, and he was like, no, it should be that way. It should be that way. Like, he was just, like, had this sense that he could do it, you know? And then he did it. And the reason why I wanted to tell this story was because it was, a story that was about him giving these students a voice and a sort of self-esteem and sort of like a forum or a sort of place to be able to discover themselves. And it was not because I wanted to do a show about, like, you know, musical theater, and it wasn't that I wanted to do a show about the most talented kids in the world who go on to become Broadway stars. It's like I specifically didn't want to do that show. But what drew me to it was the environment. And I was like, oh, I think having done Friday Night Lights, I think I could do it. I could have a take on this, you know, on this where it would be about the stories of family and relationships and community. And yes, the center of it is this theater and this, you know, and which is this sort of beautiful and profound thing. But that it was like Friday Night Lights was a story of a community. This is also a story
right,
of a community.
Right, right. Well, yeah. At the core of the show is this beautiful idea that here's a guy who's fighting the school board and the budget and the other teachers and the students and the football coach, and everyone's conspiring against him to bring him back down to the level of expectation that most of the world deals with. And he's saying, no, these kids can be more. And there's a huge lesson about life in that most of our rules, most of our ceilings are self-imposed.
Right.
Or they're taught.
Right.
Our ceiling is taught.
Right.
And it really is one teacher. You know, the people who are amazing, who are doing amazing things in the arts or in anything, really, you can often trace it back to there was one person in their life that made them see that they could be more.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he's that guy.
Yeah.
And at the heart of the show, it's that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear you say, you know, because obviously I think when you start out on a journey like this, the first thing you probably ask yourself is, what do I not want the show to be?
Yeah. Well, you know, look, I mean, I felt like there's a definitely... I think an assumption about you know, about how musical theater would be used in film or television, about, you know, from other shows and other movies.
Sure.
Totally, I wanted to feel more like Friday Night Lights than Glee, right? Like, one of the things I learned when I did Friday Night Lights is nobody cares about fake football, right? As beautifully as we shot that football and as great as it looked like, you didn't really care innately whether the Panthers or the, you know, or won or lost, right? What you cared about was, like, is Matt Saracen's dad going to show up in the audience and how that's going to affect him? You know, it's like you cared about, like, the stories of these characters on the field, and that's what made you invest in the football and invest in the team.
Right.
You prepared the people. So it was like a similar thing. I wanted to make sure, I wanted to have you feel when one of these kids is singing a song, you know, I didn't want you to say, oh, wow, that's a great, you know, version of that song.
Like the stakes
are
whether or not.
I wanted you to feel like, oh, my God, what's mom is seeing who her daughter is and what her daughter is capable of. And she never realized it. And now she's going to make a huge sacrifice in a way that she was really never able to do as a mom for her daughter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so everything was about sort of building those stories and understanding these, both Lou's inner life and the life of these students, so that when we see them perform, it's, you know, resonating on the level of, you know, on other levels than just simply, wow, that sounds really cool. Which, by the way, it sounds really cool. It's amazing. It's been like this amazing, you know, experience, like, for me, and also to, like, come back. You know, we shoot it in New York, so it's sort of like, as you were saying, it was like I was on this path with playwriting many years ago, which I kind of, you know, really just abandoned when I came to start to write for television. And sort of it's been this very satisfying thing for me to be able to go back and in a weird way and get sort of like have that part of me like awakened.
Right. Well, in one of the episodes, I think episode 4 or 5, Josh Radnor, who plays Lou, is on stage and he's got the attention of his whole troupe and he says, isn't that what art is all about, to take something painful and make it beautiful?
Mm.
And it reminded me of something that I read that you said early in your career when you were working on the show Roswell, and you get this network note, which is more aliens,
right?
More aliens.
Right. The literal note is aliens, aliens, aliens. Yeah.
And your response was, you were more interested in how alienated teenagers feel.
Right.
And it just made me curious. You've taken on the hardest thing of all, a giant ensemble cast. You're producing a show within a show, so you not only have to shoot a show, but you have to teach all these actors choreography and all these musical right. numbers. And you've got probably 25 brand new actors in this show that are doing probably their first or second jobs. And
yeah.
I was just curious if you remember still, like, in viscerally what it felt like to be a teenager and what imprinted on you so heavily at that time that you keep kind of revisiting mm-hmm. that in your work.
I've definitely got somehow stuck, you know, at some point when I was a teenager and never got past that. I am not sure. I will say that the first show that I worked on was My So-Called Life, and Winnie Holtzman created that show, and it was a, you know, just, it was a beautiful show about adolescence and maybe one of the best. And it was at a time when nobody was doing shows about teens. And, you know, what Winnie used to say about adolescence was it was a time when everything was an emergency. And I think there's something just innately dramatic about writing about that period of time. I noticed that what happens, you know, I have a daughter now who's, you know, who's 16, and I'm watching her be at the age of all these people that I've been writing about for a long time. And, you know, one of the things that you sort of see that happens is, like, over, you know, a 3, 4, 5 year period during that time, a person completely develops, you know, who they are. they completely evolve. They can change. They can take on several different, you know, almost live several different lives within that period, and at some point sort of emerge. And, you know, it's that sort of interesting time when they're both adults and kids, when they are, you know, battling that within themselves. And as a parent, you're battling how much I let them be an adult, how much I trust them to be an adult, and what's my role, where do I need to step in as a parent. I don't know, it's just such a fascinating amount of time, and you can watch people evolve in such a profound way in that period of time when you're observing people of that age range. The other thing I will say, because I think it's a little bit of a misnomer, which is like, I think there's an assumption that when a show focuses on teenagers, that it's a show that is only for teenagers. And I do not think of that. I don't think of Friday Night Lights that way, and never did.
Well, it's one thing to look at a drama teacher in his late 40s with two kids and be able to go, oh, I can put myself in his shoes. But to remember or to be able to call up those emotions and those things from childhood enough to be able to authentically create those characters, that's impressive to me. And I do just wonder, I guess, because that quote about I'm interested in the alienation of teenagers, did you go through a period where you felt either misunderstood or alienated or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that was definitely by the way, I wasn't a theater kid in high school. I didn't have a Lou in high school, so I was.
You didn't have a gang of people that.
I was definitely like an outsider in high school, and I think when you have that perspective, you wind up always sort of having that. So I do think that who you sort of become as an adolescent, like what role you take on. It informs you through your life, whether it's something that you wind up sort of radically changing about yourself. Well, you radically change it. You have to make that choice to do that. And that period of time, you know, defines you. It's when you sort of come of age. It's when you sort of, you know, make so many choices about who you're kind of going to be, what kind of person you're going to be.
I wonder what qualities about being an outsider have given you the ability to do what you do now.
You know, there definitely is a quality in people who become writers that they're often people who, you know, are outsiders because they're observing.
Do you remember when those two worlds met? Like when you, for whatever reason, if it was protection or it was security, and when that met writing?
Well, I sort of started writing in college. Before college, I was writing songs. I wanted to be, you know, Bruce Springsteen. I was
really?
Like, yeah, it's like, that's how I sort of started thinking like, oh, that's really what I wanted to do. And then turned out I wasn't Bruce Springsteen. I decided to go to college and I went to Queens College, which I grew up in New York. And, the first semester I was in college, I had an English comp class, a basic English, you know, learning to write an essay. And my teacher, who was, probably kind of my Lou Volpe, had everybody in the class keep a journal. And she said, you had to write in the journal every week. It's a requirement for the class. It's not going to be graded, but you got to write in the journal. And like every week or so, she would say to the class, does anybody want to read any of your journal entries? And so I read my journal entry, and at the end of reading it, she said, do you realize what that is? And I said, no, what is that? She said, that's a short story.
But it was about you. It was journaling in traditional sense. So it wasn't like you were trying to write a short story.
No, but what I did was I wrote it in the form. It was observational. And it had a beginning, middle, end. It was a story. So I naturally just did that, right? And it wasn't like I was planning. I literally didn't think of it as a short story. But that got me on this path to writing, and that's what I did. And I just continued to, in college, take all kinds of writing classes, eventually a playwriting class, which is where sort of that kind of clicked for me. And then I decided, to become a playwright.
So when she said that, did you actually sort of mark that moment? Did it mean something to you? It did.
Oh yeah, it was a light bulb moment for me.
And then did you, after that, were you like, oh, I gotta try to duplicate that. I gotta learn how to.
I think I did have some natural kind of ability to do it. You know, it just was like, it was just, you know, there, I do feel like in some way I was sort of meant to do that because it came very naturally to me to write in people's voices, to write dialogue. I don't know why that is, you know, but that was definitely like.
Well, maybe that's the observational thing of just always tuning in to conversations. And
yeah.
I think about the little things that people say to us that change the course of our lives in a way.
Right.
You know, when someone says, you know, you do that better than anyone I've ever seen.
That's why I said she was my Lou Volpe, because she saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. You know, it was a funny thing. I had this experience with Lou, the real Lou, where after I read the book, I got to go meet him. He's retired now.
Okay.
He still lives in Pennsylvania. I got to meet him and spent hours and hours talking to him about his life and, you know, his work and all that stuff. And it was really great. And eventually, you know, I gave him a copy of the pilot script that I'd written.
Is that scary to do, by the
way? Well, I was nervous, and I was nervous because I had told Lou that, listen, I just want to let you know, if I was going to write a movie of this story, I would write exactly your story. But because it's a television show, it's like I'm not writing your story, really. I'm hoping you're going to see, like, yourself in this character, but it's not like, it's not literally what happened. So I was nervous about giving it to him because I didn't know whether it was going to be weird for him whether he was going to think, wow, you know, that's not me, or
you bought my life story,
you know,
and I don't recognize
that? How do you change it? Whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So he read it, and then after he read it, I saw him again because he came to set to visit the set, and he just started to tell me all the things that he loved about it, and it was so moving. I'm actually getting moved right now even thinking about it, because I, in that moment, realized what it was like to be one of Lou's students, you know, because at that moment I was, you know, like I was, you know, I was seeing the gift that he had with all these kids, you know, and the gift was that how much he saw them, how he could see them, how he could recognize the beauty in them. And I could see it because he was doing it with me. You know, and it was just this very, like, incredibly, like, moving moment. And as excited as I was to be telling this story, it made me that much more excited because I just saw what a beautiful, you know, person he is and what an amazing, you know, gift that he has to see the sort of the potential in people and the beauty in things.
Well, what you're describing is why I wanted to have you on the show in the first place, because I think that through watching your shows and connecting with your characters, I feel that same way. I feel like some of these thoughts and emotions and struggles that we all go through, when you see that reflected back at you, it makes you, like, it makes me want to try harder. It makes me want to have a moral code as strong as Coach Taylor's, or to believe in a piece of art enough to fight for it,
right?
You know, or to do the painful things to keep a family together. Those things are the things that we go through every day as people. And oftentimes we turn on the TV and we're seeing how to cook meth or how to kill zombies,
right.
And those are great, and those shows have a great place, but it's a different feeling watching your shows, and I wanted to meet you because they've been meaningful to me. And so the way that Lou Volpe sort of validated your work, you know, you validate my emotions in a sense, and I think that's a powerful thing to do as an artist. So I've really appreciated having you on and hearing you. Hearing you talk about this stuff.
Thank you. This has been great.
Well, thanks for doing it, and I can't wait to see more episodes.
minutes. All right.
And I look forward to crying on the couch. Now I'm in bed with an iPad. My wife is sleeping and the dog's snoring and I'm crying. So thank you for that.
All right, man. Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Great to meet you. Thank you, man.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed that. I love sitting down with people whose work I've watched for years and just getting insight into their whole process. And Jason was a real treat for us on the show. Make sure you check out Jason's newest show, Rise, starring Josh Radnor on NBC. And if you haven't treated yourself to Friday Night Lights or Parenthood, well, what are you waiting for? You can do some real binge crying. And then after you're emotionally spent, head over to offcamera.com for some retail therapy. Well, some online retail therapy. We have a lot of great ways to get deeper into the off-camera experience. And the best way is to sign up for the off-camera monthly subscription, which gives you unlimited access to the off-camera television show. For $4.99 a month, you can have access to our entire archive of shows that you can watch on any device at any time. Or if you have DirecTV, you can head on over to channel 239, that's the Audience Network, and watch new episodes every week. Also, check out the online store at offcamera.com. We have a treasure trove of off-camera magazines filled with exclusive photographs and uncut conversations, so you can experience off-camera in print form. Also, check out our coffee table book, Off-Camera: The Portraits. We still have some signed copies left of this beautiful 250-page book full of stunning black and white, never-before-seen portraits of the iconic artists that grace our show each week. The book makes a great gift, and if you send me an email, I can even personalize the inscription for you. So check all of that out. I want to thank you all for tuning into the show, and I hope you subscribe to our show and come back each week for new conversations. As you know, we are a small group of people making the show, and we don't have a big marketing or advertising budget. So if you love us, talk about us. If the show is connecting with you or inspiring you or just making your day a little easier, tell your story on social media. Let's not keep this show a secret, folks. So we are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can also send me an email at sam@offcamera.com. I want to thank all the fine people that work on this show. Our producer, Crawford Shippey, our editor, Nathan Shields, our graphics and communications whiz, Michaela Galvin, our studio manager, Sasha Snow, our transcriptionist, Kara Johnson, our wordsmith, Amy Jones, and our sanitation, condensation, and animal relocation expert, Matt Davidson. This show wouldn't be possible without the dedication and hard work of these fine folks. And most importantly, be sure to join us next time when I sit down with actress Andy McDowell.
I went in for a job one time. It was female lead. Had the meeting, and he said to me that he's going to hire the man first because people go to movies to see the man, not the woman. Men and women are attached to the male lead. This was a theory. And I will guarantee you there are a lot of men in this town right now that still believe that theory. Like, oh, we're so surprised a movie about a woman has done well. How ugly is that? And inside myself, I have always thought, how do you feel about your daughters and your mother?
Andy first got my attention with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and her mysterious Southern charm turned films like Four Weddings and a Funeral and Groundhog Day into instant classics. In her newest film, Love After Love, Andy gives perhaps her most intimate and nuanced performance as a grieving mother forced to move on with her life and redefine her relationships with her adult sons. Her performance is so good that it makes me perplexed and dismayed that we don't see more complex roles for women of a certain age. Andy had some opinions about that, and much more, in one of my favorite conversations to date. See you next time, off camera.